As the search dragged on, the best clues lay untouched. Major Truman Landon couldn't interest anybody in the Japanese planes he saw flying north when he was bringing in his B-17. Lieutenant Patriarca had seen Japanese planes flying north, too, but he was so concerned about alerting the Enterprise that he didn't think of anything else. The Opana radar pilot had quite a story to tell, but when the Navy asked the Army radar people whether they had any information on the Japanese flight in, nobody knew anything. And everyone forgot that radar not only can track planes in, but also track them out. Opana carefully plotted the planes returning to the north, and the information center was manned by now, but in the excitement, no one did anything with this data. It made no difference to Commander Fuchida. The Japanese leader didn't even try to cover his tracks on the flight back to the carriers. There just wasn't enough gas for deception. As fast as the bombers finished their work, they rendezvoused with the fighters 20 miles northwest of Kaina Point, then flew back in groups. The fighters had no homing device and depended on the larger planes to guide them to the carriers. Fuchida himself hung around a little while. He wanted to snap a few pictures, drop by all the bases, and get some idea of what was accomplished. The smoke interfered a good deal, but he felt sure four battleships were sunk and three others badly damaged. It was harder to tell about the airfields, but there were no planes up, so perhaps that was his answer. As he headed back alone, around 11 o'clock, a fighter streaked toward him, banking from side to side. A moment of tension, then he saw the rising sun emblem. One of the Zuikaku's fighters had been left behind. It occurred to Fuchida that there might be others too, so he went back to the rendezvous point for one last check. There he found a second fighter aimlessly circling about. It fell in behind, and the three planes wheeled off together toward the northwest, last of the visitors to depart. At his end, Admiral Kusaka did his best to help. He moved the carriers to within 190 miles of Pearl Harbor. He wasn't meant to go closer than 200 miles, but he knew that even an extra 5 or 10 miles might make a big difference to a plane short of gas or crippled by enemy gunfire. He wanted to give the flyers every possible break. Now everything had been done, and Admiral Kusaka stood on the bridge of the Akagi, anxiously scanning the southern horizon. It was just after 10 a.m. when he saw the first faint black dots. Some flying in groups, some in pairs, some alone. On the Shokaku, the first plane Lieutenant Ebina saw was a single fighter skimming the sea like a swallow as it headed for the carrier. It barely made the ship. Gas was low, nerves were frayed, time was short. In the rush, normal landing procedures were scrapped. As fast as the planes came in, they were simply dragged aside to allow enough room for another to land. Yet there were few serious mishaps. As one fighter landed on the Shokaku, the carrier took a sudden dip and the plane toppled over. The pilot crawled out without a scratch. Lieutenant Yano ran out of gas and had to ditch beside the carrier. He and his crew were hauled aboard, none the worse for their swim. Some familiar faces were missing. 27-year-old Ippei Goto, who this morning had donned his ensign's uniform for the first time, failed to get back to the Kaga. Baseball-loving Lieutenant Fusata Iida didn't reach the Soryu. Artistic Lieutenant Mimori Suzuki never made the Akagi. He was the pilot who crashed into the Curtis. In all, 29 planes with 55 men were lost. But 324 planes came safely home, while the deck crews waved their forage caps. The men swarmed around the pilots as they climbed from their cockpits. Congratulations poured in from all sides. As Lieutenant Hashimoto wearily made his way to his quarters on the Hiryu, everyone seemed to be asking what was it like, what did he do, what did he see? Now that it was all over, many of the pilots felt a curious letdown. Some bragged for another chance because they missed their assigned targets. Others said they were dissatisfied because they had only near misses. Commander Amagai, flight deck officer of the Hiryu, tried to cheer them up. He assured them that a near miss was often an effective blow. Then he had an even brighter idea for lifting their spirits. "We're not returning to Tokyo. Now we're going to head for San Francisco." At the very least, they expected another crack at Oahu. Even while Commander Amagai was cheering up the pilots, he was rearming and refueling the planes for a new attack. When Lieutenant Hashimoto told his men they would probably be going back, he thought he detected a few pale faces, but on the whole everyone was enthusiastic. On the Akagi, the planes were being lined up for another takeoff as Commander Fuchida landed at 1 p.m., the last plane in. When Fuchida reported to the bridge, a heated discussion was going on. It turned out another attack wasn't so certain after all. For a moment, they postponed any decision, to hear Fuchida's account. After he finished, Admiral Nagumo announced somewhat ponderously, "We may then conclude that anticipated results have been achieved." The statement had a touch of finality that showed the way the Admiral's mind was working. He had always been against the operation, but had been overruled, so he had given it his very best and accomplished everything they asked of him. He had gotten away with it, but he certainly wasn't going to stretch his luck. Commander Fuchida argued hard. There were still many attractive targets. There was virtually no defense left. Best of all, another raid might draw the carriers in. Then, if the Japanese returned by way of the Marshals instead of going north, they might catch the carriers from behind. Somebody pointed out that this was impossible. The tankers had been sent north to meet the fleet and couldn't be redirected south in time. Fuchida wasn't at all deterred. Well, they ought to attack Oahu again anyhow. It was Admiral Kusaka who ended the discussion. Just before 1:30 p.m., the chief of staff turned to Nagumo and announced what he planned to do, subject to the commander's approval. "The attack is terminated. We are withdrawing." "Please do," Nagumo replied. In the home port at Kure, Admiral Yamamoto sensed it would happen. He sat impassively in the Nagato's operations room while the staff buzzed with anticipation. The first attack was such a success, everyone agreed there should be a second. Only the admiral remained noncommittal. He knew all too well the man in charge. Suddenly he muttered in almost a whisper, "Admiral Nagumo is going to withdraw." Minutes later, the news came through just as Yamamoto predicted. Far out in the Pacific, the signal flags ran up on the Akagi's yardarm, ordering a change in course. At 1:30 p.m., the great fleet swung about and headed back home across the northern Pacific. South of Oahu, Ensign Sakamaki was still trying, but despite all the vows he exchanged with Seaman Inagaki, their midget sub was no nearer Pearl Harbor. A brief encounter with the reef had damaged one torpedo tube beyond repair. About noon, they ran on another reef and smashed the other tube. They worked clear again, but now they had no weapon left. "What are we going to do, sir?" asked Seaman Inagaki. "We're going to plunge into an enemy battleship, preferably the Pennsylvania. We're going to crash against the ship, and if we're still alive, we're going to kill as many as we can." To Sakamaki's surprise, Inagaki bought the idea. He tightened his grip on the wheel and shouted, "Full speed ahead!" But it was no use. The afternoon turned into a jumbled series of frustrations. Sakamaki was dimly aware of trying and trying, but just not getting anywhere. The sub wouldn't steer. The air pressure was more than 40 pounds. The hull reeked with the smell of bitter acid. He choked for air. His eyes were smarting. He was only half conscious. Occasionally, he could hear Inagaki sobbing in the dark, and he was crying too. "Let's make one more try," he gasped. But the next thing he knew, he saw Diamond Head off the port. It was dusk, and he had wandered a good 10 miles from Pearl Harbor. He was beaten, and he knew it. With his last strength, he set his course for the rendezvous point off Lanai Island, where he was to meet the mother sub I-24. Then he passed out.